Thanks for tuning in to the Animal Control Report podcast, where we help debunk the dog catcher stereotype. A lot of times people think it's a dog catcher when they hear about animal control officers. But here on the Animal Control Report, we change that by taking you inside the day-to-day operations of animal control officers. Not only will you hear stories of animal control officers, but you'll hear from industry experts as well. We are also part of the Keep It Humane podcast network. We have some amazing partners there, so check them out at keepithumane.com/podcast network. You can listen to all the animal control and animal welfare related podcast there. And let's continue to help people help animals.
There's a morning.
Good day.
And welcome to the Informaciono de Animal Control Report.
Did you just try to speak Spanish while doing an English accent?
With your hosts.
Oh my God, Ashley Bishop. I'm not sure if I want to be a host anymore. You're worrying me.
And Daniel Ettinger, this is what happens when you sleep for almost 9 hours. You wake up refreshed and you just try new languages.
Oh, it's...
Informado Control de Animal, something like that. But I don't really speak Spanish, so I don't...
It wouldn't be D, it would be de.
Well, help me out.
No, because I'm not going to pretend that I know what I'm talking about when I don't, because
you know what I do know what I'm talking about. So this morning I went to livetrap.com and I was like, you know, I wonder, we always talk about the Gravity Pro Series door trap. And I was like, I wonder what else they got that I might be interested or our listeners might be
everything.
Interested. Yeah, well, that they're literally that. But did you know they have bite sticks, like collapsible batons? Did you know this?
No, like an asp.
Exactly. Now it's not, I don't think it's the asp company
brand,
correct, but they have their own collapsible batons, and they're extremely affordable. And if you use discount code Keep It Humane, you get 10% off of that already affordable collapsible baton. So go check it out. Just put in bite stick in the search bar, again, livetrap.com, and then put in bite stick, two words, and it'll pull up. They have three versions. One expands out to 32 inches, so almost as long as my arm.
You know, and the thing that I really like about Tomahawk Live Trap is they're always trying to better the products. Like, I know that conversations are had at conferences of, like, how does this work for you, and how could I make it better?
Exactly. So I think I might just order one, just because I don't have one right now. So can I use our discount code if I order one? Is that ethical? I think it's ethical. Why wouldn't that be ethical?
I guarantee you that Kyle would tell you yes.
Well, check us out at keepithumane.com. Check out our podcast network that has all the great other podcasts that are doing some wonderful things. So keepithumane.com/podcast network. And you can find the shows like Community Cats or Crime Scene Stuff or Animal Welfare Junction Stuff that talks about some forensic veterinarian type things. So check all that out at keepithumane.com/podcast network. Bishop, what you got going on in good old Wisconsin?
I don't know. This light duty and not being able to be a part of anything related to my job is getting a little frustrating, because we've got like a major case going, and then they often command went a completely different route than I would have, where they're just having a local vet do a necropsy on an animal, whereas I could have gotten a forensic exam done. So it's a little frustrating.
So they're not even conferring with you in those moments?
Nope, because I am currently light duty and delegated to the records department and doing open records requests, and that is all I am doing.
Okay. Well, I don't want to get too much in the weeds because I want you to still have a job. So we'll just keep that moving. Ray, it's no longer Ray After Dark. It's Ray. It's a ray of light this morning. What do we have going on for our segment, the supplemental report, that I'm not going to try to say in Spanish?
So today we're going to talk about the arguments for and against pet-inclusive housing and the differences between pet-friendly housing and pet-inclusive.
Okay, cool. I'm excited to talk about that because my dog who's annoying, but I love him no matter what, is a ESA. So I'd like to ask some of that when we get to your segment. So good. That'll be fun. That'll be fun. Well, Bishop,
Daniel.
I think it's time to introduce our guest, Mel Miller. I feel like, come on down. You're the next contestant on the. Hey, we do talk about spay and neuter in your pets, so it is fitting. We should probably start doing that because, he was a big proponent of spay and neuter. Mel, are you a proponent of spay and neuter?
Of course.
Yeah. Can you
All
let
in
our
favor.
listeners know, I could read a bio, I could do all that stuff, but it's more cringy when I do it. So it's if you don't mind just letting our listeners know like who you are, kind of how you got to where you are, your journey, et cetera.
Yeah, my name's Melissa Miller. Most people call me Mel. I started walking dogs for Franklin County Animal Control in Ohio in 2006. Moved back to Michigan and worked with various rescues. Became a part of the Humane Society of the United States Animal Rescue Team in 2010. And did that until I was appointed to be the director of Detroit Animal Care and Control in 2015. I did that, overseeing humane reforms from almost a 87% kill rate to a 64% live release rate. And then played around a little bit some more in disaster response before starting where I currently am in St. Clair County, Michigan, which is located in Port Huron area, and I'm the director there. I'm also a certified canine behavior consultant and a fear-free professional.
So many
Awesome.
questions. That's
Right?
you've had a lot of experience, and I love how you started as a dog walker. So that was kind of my journey, was a dog walker back at the old municipal Denver shelter in 2010, and it just opened my eyes to like this world of opportunity to help people and help animals. And I think coming from that background really helps you understand the whole. The whole piece of it, whether it's dealing with volunteers, foster
Right.
programs, all that stuff. So it's cool to see somebody with that similar story.
Yeah, it was very interesting to get my start in shelters, walking dogs, and my dad had trained some of his friends hunting dogs when I was growing up. So I had a very Barbara Woodhouse dominance theory type background and had a lovely foster and shelter mentor who said, "Wait, wait, wait, let's try some different things," and taught me quite a lot about dog behavior before I completely became a dog nerd.
If you're watching on YouTube or Spotify, this is a dog nerd right there. That's Mooney. Okay.
So you talked about having your like in deep with the fear-free stuff. And that is super intriguing to me because I sit here and go, out in the field, there's a time and a place. And how can we incorporate some more fear-free into being out in the field? Because I kind of feel like there's times where you just got to do what you got to do. Is, can you
Absolutely.
talk to that?
Yeah, and it's not always pretty what we do in the field. I think in the dog training and behavior circles, one of the big controversies right now is the phrase least invasive, minimally aversive, and whether that includes things like shock collars or prong or choke or whatever. But when I talk about least invasive, minimally aversive in terms of field response, I'm not talking about that. So I think that's a good way to think about how we progress when it comes to humane capture of animals is stopping, assessing their environment, making sure that, is there a place where we can get them captured, cornered, in an enclosed area. In a safe space where we can then stop, reassess, and take our time to decide what tool we want to use. Part of being least invasive, minimally aversive is knowing how to use all of the tools that you have at your disposal, whether that's slip lead and catch pull, Y pull, if you're chemical capture trained, those sort of things. I like to say it's great if you can start out with a slip lead, but there's some dogs that we know simply from their body language and their behavior that the catch pull is going to be the safest for us and them. And that's also what's incredibly important, is making sure that we're safe, but also that we're not escalating force simply because we're fearful and don't have a good handle on our tools.
That's the segue I was looking for, though, because what you just said is we are fearful. And I'm not going to sit here and try to pretend that there aren't moments where a catch pull is necessary. But what I've learned over the years, and I'm just speaking solely from my experience, I don't want to say I was ever truly like scared in the job, but I think I had a general like fear of, if I screw up, this dog could really tear me up, right? And so I relied on a catch pull like it was a crutch. And then I started to learn that dogs don't really like catch pulls, and most dogs don't need catch pulls. And so I was able to start to use a rope at a safe distance and some other techniques to make sure that, you know, that animal, even if it was a little bit sketchy, the majority of animals that we dealt with in the field aren't outwardly aggressive. They're fear-based aggression, right? So understanding that and how we responded to that really has put me into a position where I just stopped using catch pulls towards the last few years that I was in the field. And so what I notice now is a lot of officers still use it as a crutch, where maybe they could try a different method instead of just saying, here's what I hear all the time. Well, I'd rather just use it to be safe, right? Instead of trying a different method. So just curious what the rest of the group thinks about that. I mean, we have two other officers on this panel. Is this a panel? This isn't a panel. This is a podcast. This podcast is called The Animal Control Report, hosted by, no, wait, we already did that in the beginning. but in all seriousness, Ray or Ashley, what are your takes on that? Like using, you like Ray and Ashley, but Ray, you're like 5 foot. You might weigh 100 pounds with a outer carrier on. So you're tiny. What's your thought on catch pulls?
I mean, I feel exactly the same way, but you know, for me, it comes down to an officer safety thing. So like I had a dog that was, you know, like if I have to come across like a huge German Shepherd or any of your large breeds, and I don't feel like I can properly handle them using a leash, because like sometimes you're in a situation where you have to get them from one place and then bring them down to your vehicle and load them, and if I lose control, then you know things can go south really fast. And I, you know, so I don't, I'm not saying that I would, you know, more so use a catch pull, but I think because of my physical capabilities that I am inclined to use it more often than probably some other officers who are larger or stronger than I am. But avoiding that as much as possible, because it's, yeah, no dog likes being on a catch pole. Yeah. So that's my take.
I am a huge proponent of the leash, and or snappy snare, because the moment you get that leash on them, I would venture to say 80 to 90% of the time, I see an immediate change in the demeanor of the dog going, oh, I know what this is. This means I am no longer in control. And so I would my first go-to is always the leash. Dan, I just took and looked at our pick of the litter from 2022, and we had asked people whether catch pull, snappy snare, leash, yeah, or lariat.
Yes.
And 50% of people said catch pull.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
And that was their immediate go-to. And honestly, I feel like I have less control with a catch pull anyway, yeah, because you can't very easily direct a dog, and it's just this, I don't know. I hate them. I do. I hate the catch pull.
And I'll say this, Mel, I want to get back to you really quick, but same goes for Chihuahuas. We have this, like, I don't think you should be ever put a catch paw on a dog under like 20 pounds. I don't. That's my personal experience and opinion.
Snappy snares work for chihuahuas.
Well, a leash works, but the reality is, I'll put this out there right now. Anybody listening, if you have a fractious chihuahua in your shelter, I will pay to come to your shelter, and I will be able to pick that dog up within 5 minutes and have it here, the Paris Hilton hold. And if I fail to do that, then I pay, right? But if I get the dog picked up, you have to pay my full flight, my hotel, and my per diem. That's the bet. Because I guarantee you, I can get that dog to that position just with time. And I know some people are listening like, yeah, right. Let's take me up on that challenge and we'll see. Because I think the reality is, it's just taking your time, being patient, being able to read the body language, and also present your own body language to make that animal feel more comfortable.
Yeah. So what kind of body language do you use then for cats?
I run the fuck away if I see
cats.
No, that's a good question. Cats are different. Because they don't communicate the same way dogs do in that aspect. And typically if a cat doesn't come over to me, I might put it in the Freeman net. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Freeman net is, I think, my favorite tool for cat capture. We, at our current location, we don't handle cat calls or go pick up stray cats. If folks can put an animal, an injured or sick cat, into a carrier and bring it to us, we will treat it. And if we need to, either TNR it once it's healthy, or do a barn cat program if it's not friendly. Sometimes they're very friendly when they're very sick, and then get more opinions as they get better.
Can we talk a little bit about the fear-free aspect of the drugs? Like I have a hard time comprehending and understanding, like, medicating a dog for the rest of its life. And is that what fear-free does? Is that a component? Is that, like, help me understand if that's, I just want to make sure I understand fear-free correctly.
Sure. So first disclosure, I'm not a veterinarian. I'm a certified consultant, a behavior consultant for canines, right? So I'm just going to talk about this generally and not talk about specific medications. So in terms of fear-free, it's helping an animal manage some really, really stressful stuff. So if you think of certain procedures that you might go through where they might give you Xanax or Valium to keep you calm, or in a twilight sleep, or where you're just out for a little bit, that's one of the ways you could think about doing things like giving cats gabapentin. Oh, I said I wasn't going to say names.
That's the name of my new single. That's the name of my new single. It goes, it's called Gabapentin, and it starts off like, oh, Gabba, 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 sitting in the pen. That was all that was. We're good.
So yeah, there's certainly some medications.
Gabba, 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 sitting in, okay, stop.
Good grief, Daniel.
There are going back to refocus though. There are medications that are prescribed that can maybe take the edge off.
Right. And the most important thing is that we're using current medications under the guidelines of a veterinarian who's trained in behavior. I recently was just working with a shelter dog whose veterinarian of record had, and I am going to name this, had put one of their dogs on ACE promazine, which 20, 25 years ago was a medication commonly used, but we know now all it does is slow motor movement. It does not change their ability to understand their environment. So while they look sedated to us, their brain is actively processing noise and the things happening around them. So it's not truly sedating. It's just slowing motor movement. When you think about that, that's a little scary to be thinking about being in an environment where you know what's going on around you, but you physically can't move your body fast enough. So there's way better medications than that. So if you have a dog who I will not, in our shelter, do a medication for a dog who is showing snarl, advanced ladder of aggression behaviors. So snarl, showing teeth, lunging, air snapping is not a dog that I'm comfortable medicating. However, dogs that are showing fear behavior, that are growling, grumbling, showing a no harm paw, telling me all I really want is space, and showing other signs of constant stress. The whites of their eyes are red, so their scleras are red or pink. If they're white or color, you can see that they're always flushed underneath their coats. Sweaty paws, hypersalivation, all those things that show their adrenaline response is really in high gear. Those are the animals that we might consider. Is there something that we can help them minimally with getting a good night's rest so that they can start coping with stress and we can start introducing them to routine? The goal is not to have an animal that needs constant medication. There will be some of those animals. For instance, they go into a home on a foster contract and they're back in 2 days because their separation anxiety or isolation distress is so significant that they will probably need medication for quite some time to help them learn while they're learning different separation anxiety or isolation distress protocols in a home. So that I think is a little bit different than what you're referring to, Daniel, of we're going to pop a dog on, you know, 200
for the rest of their life.
Rest of their life. It's more to help them cope with the shelter experience. For instance, our shelter, all of our dog kennels are 4x4s. There's no guillotine runs. Okay. They have no option to move away from us. So it's very stressful. We don't have a ton of dogs on medication, but we will use that if we see somebody who's just completely shut down, if it's affecting their eating habits, those kind of things.
Is there an appropriate time frame that is like listed on the medication or suggested by your vets about how long to have the animals on that type of medication, and if there's any negative health effects from long-term usage?
Yeah, so again, not a veterinarian, but in terms of what I've seen with individual clients or what I've seen in shelters, there's different types of medications. Some require some onboarding, right? So we have a loading dose and it takes 4 to 6 weeks to really start showing some change in behavior and then making adjustments on those dosages. Some medications only take 20 to 40 minutes to start activating. Those typically have a very short half-life of between 4 to 12 hours, depending on the medication. So I look at the biological processes that dogs and cats go through, from capture to various assessments or holistic assessments that we do in a shelter. While capture behavior in field is important, it really only tells us what the dog or cat does at the most stressful point of their existence, which is us capturing them and putting them in a box, right? So that information is important, but not the totality of their behavior. If you're familiar with the 72-hour adrenaline cortisol response, or if you've ever been in a car accident, you know that, you know, at first when EMS arrives on scene, if they're like, yeah, I'm just going to have to cut off your pinky finger, you're like, yeah, whatever, make the pain stop, you know, even though it has nothing to do with that. Then about 3 to 5 days later, all of a sudden you ache in all these different places. And that's a function of, you know, injury and then adrenaline as well, blocking your pain receptors. And then that turning into cortisol and as your body processes lactic acid in your muscles. So that pain that comes 3 to 5 days later is really important when you look at the dogs and cats intake date to also see, you know, when you're interacting with that animal 3 to 5 days later, they may start to show pain behaviors or may become protective of certain parts of their bodies, which is, you know, incredibly important to be aware of, especially if they've been, quote unquote, a good dog the first couple days and they've been very compliant. They may start to show you that they aren't as comfortable as what they thought. Once you get past that 3 to 5 day window, you also have to assess whether they got their intake and all their vetting very close to the day that they had intake, or whether it was 4 or 5 days later and then they had to go through a stressful veterinary check and rabies vaccine and those kind of things. And did we start that cortisol clock over again in that 72-hour period? Especially doing large-scale cases, you may be seizing a dog and then have to do full-on forensic exams. If you're working in the hundreds, you might be doing forensic exams 3 or 4 days later. So that cortisol clock is going to restart on them because of the type of handling that we're doing. You know, sometimes having to do a really quick muzzle wrap and restrain so we can get the right medications and diagnosis and photographs on board for a forensic exam. So if you're seeing within a week that a dog or cat hasn't started to eat at least during downtime, nighttime, quiet times in the shelter, that is where I think a good conversation with your veterinarian would be about putting, is there a medical component that we can be adding into this to help them with processing? The Association of Shelter Veterinarians defines a long stay as anything more than 2 weeks. So we really have to think about long-term stay. And a lot of us think of that as like a month, 2 months. But realistically, to live in the type of environment that most of our shelters are, if at 2 weeks you're expecting that we're still going to have another possibly 30 days till this animal is going up for adoption or longer because they're recovering from medical or anything like that, that's another conversation to have. The ASPCA intake protocols do have some recommendations about medication for cats, especially feral cats that might be coming into your facility to help them with if you're doing TNR, because basically they're coming in, being held for a day or two, getting their surgery, being held for a day, and then going back out. So there are some benefits of medications for those non-social animals that are really just in the shelter for a short time.
So really, I mean, by our standards, it's not by the, you know, veterinary standards that you said by being 2 weeks being considered long-term, but by our standards of long-term, there's really not a good reason to be keeping an animal on these medications long-term. So we should not be seeing necessarily these animals going home and having to continue staying on them for potentially the rest of their lives.
Right. Unless there's an underlying disorder that accompanies or set of behaviors that accompanies that animal. It's important to have conversations with your veterinarians of, you know, if you've had a dog on anti-anxiety medication and it's taken them 3 months to get adopted, it's important to talk with the potential adopters about how to dose down and immediately get their veterinarian in touch with your medical team on appropriate ways to dose down. We don't want to just all of a sudden take them off of Traz and Prozac, right? Because that's no fun for anybody. But there definitely are medications that they can wean off of because they're not in military school, right? Where there's not many options to make bad choices. Their lives are very, very regimented for a lot of shelters. You know, we wake up, we have breakfast, we go outside again, we have dinner, we go to sleep. Right. So
Melissa, are there any pieces of advice that you can give to people who operate shelters that aren't certified fear-free that they could start to implement to improve the lives of dogs and cats that are in there?
Absolutely. The fear-free sheltering initial certification is free to anybody who works in shelters. It's about a 4 to 5 hour module. So four to 5 hours of different modules. So you don't have to sit down and take it all at the same time. The stuff that I always think about is on their level, what is scary? So, with cats are arboreal predators, right? They like to be up, they like to be in trees, they like to be on the back of our couches and in windowsills to observe. So, as much as possible, not having cats close to the floor. If a cat is, you're at max capacity, you have no other choice but to use those bottom shorelines. If you have somebody who's stressed, has stress, diarrhea, is not eating on a regular basis, thinking about is there somebody who is just green light cuddle bug cat that maybe could switch with them so that the more fearful cat can be up higher, is important. Where in the shelter dogs are in terms of reactivity is important as well. Are they in a kennel where, when you're taking all the other dogs out, they have to watch every single dog pass them? If that's the case, is there a different kennel that might suit them during the period of time that you're moving them? Is there a visual barrier you can put up? Things that can help them a lot. I'm a huge fan of using Rescue as a disinfectant because it is the only disinfectant out there that gets rid of the smell of stress pheromones that you and I can't smell, but they definitely can. So, especially when cleaning intake rooms, it's a really great disinfectant to be using for that purpose, especially if you're noticing animals coming into intake room areas, vet exam areas, and immediately put on the brakes. They're smelling something we can't smell. So, also thinking about their sense of hearing being so much better than ours, what are they hearing? Animals do like music, they do like audiobooks, they like all that stuff, but they hear so well, it doesn't need to be at our hearing level. So, I know sometimes in the past, I've had kennel staff that have a radio on because the dogs like music, but the radio is blaring and it's like the classic rock station, which isn't necessarily, we want to stick with our like NPR, calm talking radio, and sports talk
Welcome
radio where they're
to the
arguing about stuff.
Animal Control Report with your hosts.
Right.
We're not doing that. This is enlightening, and I'll be honest. I think I've seen a few fear-free presentations at conferences, and they haven't been great. I'm just, and the reason they haven't been great is because they don't. It didn't seem to dive into it the same way, and I had this taste in my mouth that it was just like, let's medicate everybody, let's never pull on the leash. Let's never use catch poles, and it's there has to be some practical applications of it. And for us as animal control officers, in that sense, like I'm all for making the quality of life for animals in our care better, whether it's putting on classical music at a low volume, right, or whether it's having Bob Barker and The Price is Right in the background at a low volume, I think is really cool. And we just have to figure out ways to continue to build on that. As far as like the general care, because as I talk about all the time, whether it's on the show or through other avenues, is until we get to the point where we have access to care throughout the communities, we're going to have animals in the shelter and they're going to be in the shelter for a long period of time, right? And so we have to figure out and continue to make ways to make that comfortable for them. As we kind of transition here, before we get into our segment about just like how, housing and pets, before we get into that. Is there anything, Mel, that you'd like to talk about additionally that is outside of the fear-free that we didn't get a chance to cover yet?
I think just on returning back to how you use your equipment and really being trained on that, remembering that when we use catch poles, we should never be in front of the animal pulling. That animal should always be in front of us. If that means that you have to do a couple, turns like a horse in a corral where you're going around in circles a little bit and moving a few steps closer to your vehicle each rotation, then that's great. But we should never be in the situation where we're pulling an animal by its neck on a catch pole, unless obviously we're in a situation where the animal's lower than us and we have to get it up to a safe ground level.
I think that's really good. And if you have a second person where you can have two catch poles, it gets you a little bit better control of them too, and reduces the amount of pulling one way or the other. So having that second person is also very helpful.
Yeah, I really like that method, as well as what you had mentioned earlier of being able to use a soft leash. You always have the option with a slip leash to be able to muzzle wrap if
yes,
you're trained and comfortable with it. And again, it doesn't always look pretty, but it keeps you safe. And muzzle wrap and scoop and in the box in 5 seconds is so much more important than necessarily what it looks like.
I love the muzzle wrap. And honestly, I use it more for not even necessarily that I think that the animal is going to bite, but I use it as a distraction because then they're not fighting me as hard, because they're more worried about what's on their nose. And that's the big reason why I love the soft leash and being able to muzzle wrap and all that.
Absolutely.
You know, there's at least 3 or 4 different ways to muzzle wrap. It's actually kind of fun to demonstrate that in person. And I was taught by one of the best, I like to say, he refers to it as a half hitch. And it's just a neat technique to do it. But anyway, we can show that in person sometime or on this. Well, if you're watching on YouTube, we can do it on YouTube one time. But
get Mooney up here.
He will do it, and then he'll be like, and then he'll be like, and then he'll be like, gabba gabba gabba, petting petting petting.
Yeah,
that should be a commercial for gabba petting.
I thought we talked about you and your singing, and that it wasn't supposed to happen on the show anymore. We're gonna lose listeners, Dan.
I don't know. Maybe I'll be nominated for a Grammy because I sing so well.
I don't think Grammys are for singers.
Well, that's fine. Speaking of not for singers, let's jump into the supplemental report. With our ray of shining hope, our savior of rain, whatever. Just Ray, how are you doing today?
I'm cold. I'm wearing sweater. I'm getting whiplash from the warm and cold weather here.
Oh,
it was
no.
like 69 yesterday, and now it's like 30. I don't like this.
That's why I'm here. See you, Colorado. So you have an interesting supplemental report about some, basically one of the, honestly, in my opinion, one of the, I would say, spiciest topics in this country is being able to live somewhere and have a pet.
Yeah, there is, so like right now, about half of all rental properties are considered pet friendly, and about 9% of those are considered pet inclusive. And there's differences. So like the pet inclusive movement is relatively new, particularly after COVID, when, you know, housing and affordability just completely plummeted. So real quick, to understand everything moving forward, pet friendly is what you typically think of. You go to a new place, they charge some kind of pet deposit. There's some kind of pet rent. They have restrictions on breeds and weight and size and all of that. That's your pet friendly. And then you have a pet inclusive, which is this new movement where it takes out all of those restrictions. So no matter what kind of animal you have, no matter their breed, any of that, they are allowed to be there and you don't have a deposit or any kind of pet rent to pay. And there's this push for moving towards that because there is significant data that has been put, that has been taken in surveys from the pet inclusive housing movement, showing that people who don't have animals, about 35% of them would get one if their current rental allowed that. And the data to support that in favor of like property managers is that they threw the statistic out there on their page that 83% of property managers say that those pet friendly vacancies can be filled faster, and that vacancies that are already pet friendly are easier to fill. So they estimate that if more properties, all, well, the other half of rental properties out there became at least pet friendly, that we could rehome almost an additional 9 million pets into households.
Wow.
And that, I mean, it's a huge number. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I know for me, when I've moved several times, and you know, I come across different properties where it seems like they make up some kind of abstract number on what kind of pet deposit they want. Are they going to charge pet rent or not? You know, you can have nothing over 35 pounds, and it's frustrating because then it just limits your ability to find housing. And one of the most significant factors today for pet surrenders is because they're moving to a property that does not allow animals, and that's the only reason. And so if we can eliminate that, or at very least make it easier with less restrictions or these fees that aren't so high, then more people are going to be able to keep those animals. So it'll be less animals entering the shelter, and you can help with that human animal bond. And there's several states that are doing this. California's got one, Florida, Illinois has one. They are trying to pass a federal bill as well that was proposed a few years ago, and it's still working its way through there. So we'll see how that works out.
You know, one thing that I always encourage our landlords to do here, and I feel like could be beneficial to landlords being more willing to allow the pets, is requiring proof of licensing. Because if they have to license their pets, then they have to get them the veterinary care to, at bare minimum, get a rabies vaccine. Mm-hmm. So those people are theoretically going to be more responsible, thereby having fewer issues within the apartments, which is, I think, a win-win for everybody. And then they know what animals are actually in their apartments and things like that. So that's one thing I've been trying to push for here, is getting landlords to put it in their lease that every year, you know, you got to submit your current license information. I don't know.
Yeah,
that's just food for thought.
Would be less likely to try and hide those animals coming in.
Mm-hmm.
You have a more open conversation with whoever your property management or your landlord is. And you know what, I don't know about what you guys, what I've seen before, I've seen, you know, landlords charge as much as $500 deposit for per pet. Pet rent is anywhere from, you know, $15 a month per dog up to like $150 per dog. Yeah. for pet rent. And it's so unrealistically affordable, especially when you consider the state of housing now.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem like a good business model, because you can have more people in your, right? The goal of the landlord is to get money, right? They want to make money. And right. And if their vacancies are sitting longer because you can't bring your dog or your cat or something with you, then that poses a problem to them. And I know that one of the main arguments out there is like, well, the potential damage that dogs or cats can pose, but in reality, that damage is really next to nothing. I mean, you change out some carpets, but I mean, I can tell you it from my experience as an officer going into hundreds of thousands of residences, the damage that's caused by people is by people, not so much their animals.
Right.
And there are outliers with hoarders, but again, that essentially ends up falling on the owner.
But again, if you require that licensing, then you're going to know a little bit more about the animals that are there. You're going to have better coverage for insurance purposes if you're providing the rabies vaccine information. And I don't know how it is everywhere else, but here I believe it's a law that between residences, you're supposed, or renters, you're supposed to be changing the carpets out every so often anyway. So it's a moot point.
Yeah. They're really, I mean, honestly, in all of the research and everything that I've done, there really is no good argument to not allow animals.
You know what it is?
Yeah.
They just don't like animals. Or seriously, or they had one bad experience, right? And that changes everything. And that's the problem that we have. And I think, is that going to change the issue that we have with overpopulation? No, but will it help a little bit? Yeah, absolutely. Like, again, I like that we have all these things that are born out of necessity because we have overpopulation. Where I keep going back to, and where I will keep going back to, is we have to continue to make programs available for people. You know, like we talked about a few episodes ago, how California it had a bill proposed to allow vet techs to be able to do cat neuters, right? Like, we have to figure out ways like that to stop the problem coming in. And I do see a vision. And I think this is what gets me in trouble in some aspects, is I get so animated about this type of stuff that I can't control my behavior. So when we talk about all this stuff, I kind of get emotional.
You need some trazodone or gabapentin.
Gabba gabba gabba. But no, in all seriousness, I'll get really emotional about it, right? And I forget that like people are really trying their hardest. And I'm like, stop. I'm like, what are we doing? Why are we not succession planning? We're not succession planning. We're not talking about what we're doing right now to affect the future. All we're doing is trying to stop what's happening right now. And so if we can start to build for succession planning, at some point, you may think I'm crazy. Isn't that a song? It is now.
Yeah, but it doesn't sound like that.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like that at all. Thank you, Mel, for playing along. Do you want to sing it? Can you tell people how the tone goes?
You might be right. I might be crazy.
Yes, it is that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. See? But in all seriousness, like, we're doing it now and we shouldn't be. We're doing it now and we shouldn't be. Is we're rescuing animals from other countries, right? Like, we got to focus on what we got going on here. And then at some point, we will have a shortage. This is the goal, because we'll be spaying, neutering everything. We'll have a shortage, and then we'll have to go to other countries and bring animals here. That's just my goal for 2097.
At least you made it realistic.
Not well, like 2025.
Like, a lot of the stuff.
Shut up, Daniel.
A lot of the stuff we talk about is like things that, you know, take so long, like all these bills and stuff, they take so long, but it literally, like, changing your pet policy is almost immediate. It's up to every landlord, every property management to have that, and they could immediately put that into effect. It's a quick change, and it has, as for me, like, that's why I like am so passionate about that topic, because it is, to me, almost as important as access to care. It is one of the biggest problems that owners are facing today, and it affects everybody who in particular is renting.
Mm-hmm.
Mel, do you see that a lot in your community?
Absolutely. I'd say probably 40% or more of our owner surrenders are people facing housing changes, and they are either their leases have increased this year and they need to go to somewhere that is less expensive. Their housing, they're moving from a rented house to an apartment, or they are moving in with family or even parents. We've got a lot of folks that are moving in with family, and there's issues with family members and pets. So a lot of our owner surrenders have to do with housing. And I can't remember the statistic, but and Ray, you might know it off the top of your head, but there is a really great statistic when talking with landlords about there's a certain percentage of the folks that have pets stay longer and rent those units longer, as well as they're more likely to pay on time and consecutively.
Yeah, I don't remember the exact amount, but it's like over 60%.
That's funny because I'm about to move when my lease is up. But that's okay. Don't tell my landlord. Don't tell my landlord. It's, you know why? Because we don't have a washer and dryer here, and I got to go to the laundromat. I'm 45 years old. I don't need to be going to the laundromat. Okay. Put a
That's
washer and
where you're
dryer here. That's all I'm asking.
going to. Did you have a problem finding a pet friendly place there when you moved there?
Well, I'm glad you asked. So when I moved up to, Ray kind of knows my history and my story a little bit. When I moved up to Summit County, Colorado, one of the reasons I didn't move to Summit County, Colorado was the rent was exorbitant. What's that word?
Exorbitant. Exorbitant.
It was ridiculous. I mean, anyway, but they don't allow pets. I'm not even joking. You can go to Zillow right now, and 90% of the listings do not allow pets. So I ended up moving to Idaho Springs, and the owner of the property, cool guy. I had to explain what I did. I had to tell him, like, hey man, I'm all about responsible pet ownership. This is what I do for a living. My dog is housebroken. Like, he actually is going to come to work with me. Like, it's not going to be an issue. And so I sold him on that. And then when I moved to Southern California, the same thing, same thing. Like, no pets, no pets, no pets. And I was like, well, I'm crazy enough to get an ESA designation for my dog. So I went and saw a psychologist, and they were like, yeah, this guy needs more than a ESA. He needs some GABA, 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 pen, pen, pen. And so I was able to get the ESA, which saves me in some aspects. But the reality being is it is difficult. And as I'm looking now, because I am starting to look, because I do want to get a little bit of a bigger place now that I'm kind of settling in here. And knowing what's available, it's tough. It's tough. I think it should be illegal. Like, you shouldn't be, like, maybe you can have like a pet maximum. Like, you can't have 27 cats, but man, like, let us have like the normal amount of animals and be fine with
Well,
it.
that's the aim of the whole pet inclusive movement, from changing from pet friendly to pet inclusive.
Well, I love it. That's a great supplemental report. Great supplemental report. Does anyone have anything else before we wrap it up? Anybody want to sing a song together?
Gabba gabba gabba, pet
Pen,
pen.
pen, pen. Let's go, Mel. You're always welcome back on the Animal Control Report. Check us out wherever you watch your podcast. That's YouTube, Spotify. We also are available on our website, keepithumane.com. Keepithumane.com. Don't forget to like, share, rate the podcast. Also, I forgot to mention this. This is the most important part of all of this episode. I started a tattoo challenge, or some may call it a cat tattoo challenge. And Bishop, I could see you screaming over there. So what had happened was, it's funny because we're talking about all this stuff, access to care. I was teaching a class, and I was drawing on the whiteboard cats. So I put a cat plus a cat in on the whiteboard, and then underneath it, what we did is an assignment. I asked people to look up how many litters can one cat, what am I trying to say? How many litters can a cat have in a year, right? And then how many kittens per litter can that cat have, right? And so we start to draw it out. Well, the top two cats turned into a tattoo, not intentionally. Two of the students were like, we're getting that as a tattoo. And I was like, no, you're not doing that. It's the worst drawing in the world.
Drawing? You
Drawing?
said drawing.
Well, I'm from Pittsburgh. We talk different. And I was like, you're not getting that. So I get a text message as soon as my airplane lands. And sure enough, two dudes from class got the drawing of the cats on their back calf. And you can check this out. I posted it in ACO Talk on Facebook. If you're not a member of the group, just DM the show and we'll get you in there. And I'll put it somewhere else just because it's fun. So I go back, teach the class. I teach this class like once a quarter. So I go back and I'm telling the story last time. Two other dudes get the tattoo. And I was like, look, I'm going to get it. I have to get it. I'm obligated to get it because two people got it. So now two guys got it. While we're there, the one guy, brilliant. He's brilliant. He's like, because I was like, what do I do? If more people want to get the tattoo, I can't keep getting the same tattoo. And he was like, duh, you're going to get kittens underneath it. I was like, oh my God, that's brilliant. So what it is, here's the challenge. If you get the tattoo, you get to draw the cat. That I'm getting the kitten that I'm getting in the same kind of style, so it doesn't look crazy good because I have horrible drawing. And then I'll get kittens the whole way down the back of my calf. So if you're interested, you can find that photo on our. I should put it on the website. I might have a whole body of cats. I better chill.
Hey Dan. Dan, you should come to HSUS and we'll go together.
You keep trying to invite me there. What days of the week is HSUS? Do you know?
Wednesday through Saturday.
Can't do it. That's the day that I work. Sorry.
You suck.
I could go Monday, Tuesday.
I mean, I'll be there Saturday through Sunday.
All right, we'll talk offline. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks again for listening. Don't forget to have your pet spayed or neutered. And as always, help people help
Help animals.
animals and keep it humane. Okay, how do I stop recording? I always do this. Oh, wait, right here.